Wuhan, but in New Zealand, you didn't really have to deal with any kind of major enforcement per se. Could you talk about that in the few seconds we have left?
Yeah, I think empathetic leadership, as we've seen in New Zealand, helps. But actually, Australia has got a different style of government, and they've also succeeded. But the best performing country on earth has actually been Taiwan, I think, because they acted very early. They didn't need a lockdown, and that was because they had a very strong public health agency, and they started managing their borders in January, and they did everything right. So I think they've had
Michael
a model
Baker,
response.
We're going to have to leave it there, but we're going to continue with a post show and post online at democracynow.org. From New Zealand, I'm Amy Goodman, Ruben Gonzalez. Be safe.
And this is KBOO Portland. It's 8 a.m. on Tuesday, and as many of us know, that means it's time for the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show with your hosts, Abe and Joe.
Well, it isn't bad. In fact, it was part of the struggles in Chile historically when housewives came out, women who were homekeepers, and fought against the Allende regime, and then fought against the Pinochet regime. So it became a thing in Chile. So it has a kind of historic precedent. Though I don't think you can fight a virus by beating on things. I'm not that much of a magical thinker, but we're lucky because we have a president who is a totally magic thinker, and that's that's going to save us. It would have saved us if we all had just believed when he denied there was a problem with the virus. We weren't all on board. You see, we just all thought, gee, a virus, it'll probably spread.
This is the Abe and Joe Talk Radio program on KBOO 90.7 FM. This is a talk radio show. We would very much appreciate your input. You can reach us at 503-231-8187 if you would like to weigh in on the topic of the day. As it turns out, the topic of the day is very much the same as it was last Tuesday when we talked to you. There's a pandemic on. We have inept leadership. There are millions of people out of work, and the future looks very uncertain. Did that about sum it up?
Well, I think that's a fair summation, except I think it's not just uncertain. I think it unfortunately is certain. Here's what I think. I think that when you tell everybody to open up and act like it was a year ago, let's say, there are some people who will do that. There's a fevered group of right-wing people who will do that with flags of the Confederacy and American flags and so on. And there's most of us who will say, "Oh, gee, it's interesting. I didn't buy a thing that I was going to buy, and I'm not missing it." In other words, there is not any huge pent up demand for stuff. That's my suspicion. I don't have a crystal ball. I don't know if that's right. It might be the opposite. Everybody might go crazy and buy themselves a fancy bed and a bigger screen TV and a new house and a new car and so on. But I'm guessing that people are going to be more conservative, and that the great gamble of Trump, who hopes for a fevered economy to make him president of the United States yet again, it's just not going to come true. And I think that his paranoia, his fear, his craziness will actually lead him to attempt to violate the Constitution grossly by not having the election on the traditional day and time. That's what I think.
Well, I really hope you're wrong about that last part.
Well, I'm probably wrong. I've been wrong about a lot of things, so, you know.
No, Joe, you've never once been wrong in all the many years you and I have been working together.
Well, how do I see? There's the problem. If I say I have been wrong, I lose. If I say you're right, I've never been wrong, I lose. I mean, I just don't see the advantage of the response.
I'll stipulate to your contention that you've occasionally been wrong. Okay.
Okay. Thank you.
But here's what I'm worried about.
What is it you're worried about?
Okay. So, to quickly recap the United States response since the coronavirus pandemic became known. The president knew about this way back in December. He did nothing for two crucial months. Then he issued the inevitable and absolutely necessary. Well, actually, let me backtrack that a little bit. State governors started issuing the inevitable and necessary stay-at-home and social distancing orders that we had to put in place to stop the spread of the virus. The president, of course, dithered and continued to downplay the severity of the outbreak, made false claims about how quickly it might go away, started pushing snake oil cures and that sort of thing. Meanwhile, state governors...
He owns snake oil stock. That's my theory.
Well, we already do know that. He does own a small share in a company that manufactures hydroxychloroquine.
Ah.
Not a big stake, but he does have a stake, yes. So we sort of lurched in this country, with some states being much more diligent and thorough about their response to the virus than others, and really all of this unfolding without any sort of coherent national plan or strategy, either for shutting down the country or reopening the country. So, of course, as you could have predicted, any observer of the United States could have predicted, once widespread stay-at-home orders went into effect, of course, we started to experience the economic collapse that is ongoing, and immediately the pressure started mounting from factions on the right to reopen the economy. Now, here's the problem. As we've detailed on this program, the partial reopening of the country is happening, and we are beginning to see now, in almost all of those places, rises in the new number of coronavirus cases and rises in the number of deaths. So what this means, writ large, is that we may very well see a situation in which many parts of the country, by prudently practicing social distancing, were able to bring the spread of the virus under control. That is going to be undermined by the states opening prematurely. We're going to see a spike in the number of new cases and deaths, resulting in a second wave of the virus, which means the whole country is going to have to go back under lockdown, which means all of the sacrifices that we made, economic and otherwise, to get through this will have been for naught, because certain people and certain business factions and interests couldn't wait it out with sufficient patience and discipline. And this is all the more ironic because, as you mentioned, most people are probably not going to feel safe going back out into public and doing public things. So you're going to have, and we're seeing this right now, especially in a lot of states in the Old South, restaurants that are open, that are having to seat customers spaced way apart. They're doing something like half the business they normally would have done, which is hardly worthwhile in terms of reopening. So places are going to open up again. Owners are not going to be able to make sufficient revenue. They're going to be risking financial collapse, and we're all going to have to go back under lockdown again.
I think you're right. I would add one other major factor. It is clear now that the Republican Senate and the president do not intend to help small businesses. In fact, they're faking it and not doing it What's really happening is large corporations are making a killing, and the banks are making a killing. And one of the things, by the way, that's also happening is the meatpacking industry is keeping secret the number of people who have the virus, just so we can all get our pig chops.
Yeah. And we're also looking at faulty data in a lot of places.
Well, there's no data. The president refused to do testing for the nation.
No, that's right. He refused to institute a nationwide testing policy, which is, I think, a bare minimum for reopening the economy to even the smallest extent. Well, what I'm talking about is, for example, there's a public health official in Georgia who was fired for refusing to falsify data after that state partially reopened its economy.
So
we're dealing with a lot of known unknowns now and a lot of unknown unknowns, all of which could have been better understood and better mitigated by something approaching a coherent strategy for the nation. And I want to point out to everybody listening that as of right now, May the 26th, there is still no nationwide testing and contact tracing strategy in place.
But this gave an occasion for you to quote Rumsfeld of all people.
Oh, the known unknowns? Yeah.
Yeah.
I never miss a chance to quote Rumi.
It's one of the few good, amusing things he ever said.
Yeah, indeed.
Never mind. Sorry. Non sequitur.
Yeah, so I think the massive mismanagement of this crisis is only going to broaden it and deepen it in the end, and ultimately make the consequences far worse than they might have been. We're already seeing that in terms of almost 100,000 people dead now in the United States. And as I mentioned, the very, very real possibility of extended economic deprivation as a result of the lack of any sort of coherent response.
Well, and I know people who are actually facing the very strong likelihood of either losing their jobs or, if they're unemployed at the moment, never, ever, ever, ever able to get those jobs back. It's a real economic, it's going to be an enormous economic blow. Now, when you have an economic blow like that, just opening things up is not going to solve the problem of people buying stuff which they don't need, which is how our economy works.
Well, I think that's an oversimplification. Yes, people buy a lot of stuff they don't need.
I mean, yes, it's an oversimplification. But I'm right.
So a quick survey of the states that have partially reopened their economies in not a very disciplined sort of way, virtually all of them have seen an increase in COVID-19 positive cases and hospitalizations and in deaths. It's particularly prevalent in, you know, and it pains me to have to say this, the places where you might expect, red states. Louisiana has not reopened its economy because it was already the site of a regional hotspot. It continues to see an elevation in cases and hospitalizations and deaths. But if you take a little tour through the old Confederacy, Oklahoma, Mississippi, Alabama, Georgia, South Carolina, North Carolina, Tennessee, Arkansas, they all are seeing elevated COVID-19 cases. And this persists into the Midwest and upper Midwest, where a lot of states are seeing fairly large spikes in new cases, like North Dakota, for example. But that's because it just took a long time for North Dakota to see any cases at all. So really, even a small increase there is going to register as a pretty large percentage increase.
Really a horrifying aspect to this, because it is like almost all diseases in our world, in our culture, harder on persons of color, on persons who are poor, than it is on the more privileged people, the more privileged ruling class Caucasians. And it's really clear that the need for a national health system, something like perhaps Holland or Denmark or Norway or any of those northern European countries, is absolutely needed. And what's also clear is we're a hell of a long way from getting it.
We're absolutely a hell of a long way. Yeah. Yeah. It really beggars belief that at this point, almost at the end of May, this pandemic has been raging full blown for 3 or 4 months now, and we still have nothing approaching a coherent national strategy, either for testing, for contact tracing, for distribution of personal protective equipment, or, and then we're going to talk about this in more detail in a little bit, disbursement of funds to ensure that the economy is not entirely broken by this public health crisis.
Well, and
I just have to say, we are failing on virtually every front.
Yeah, and I know many people, perfectly competent people with very good middle-class jobs who now are unemployed, who filed for unemployment insurance, and the system is so snafu'd that they have not got a coherent response from the government. So they're sitting there being very, very frightened because they have payments on houses and cars and all sorts of things that may get actuated, which could lead in turn to people being even more messed up, more homeless, more frightened, and more losing the status that they gained through their hard work and their college degrees and so on.
Yeah.
Fellas, we have a call.
I don't want to... we'll get to the caller in just a second.
All right.
I do want to point out, I think this is important to note, that I've been characterizing the national response as pretty ham-handed and incoherent, and that's largely true. But there have been some bright spots. Particularly, I'm talking about the robust and expanded unemployment insurance that Bernie Sanders helped usher into being. That had a very rocky liftoff, as many states' unemployment systems are antiquated and poorly equipped. But in the intervening weeks, that has actually managed to get a lot of money into the hands of a lot of people who really need it. The problem is that it's set to expire here pretty quickly, and based on the rumblings we're hearing out of the conservative side of Congress, it's going to be a heavy lift to have it maintained or even expanded the way it needs to be. So there have been some good things.
Well, yeah, and I don't understand the public in this matter. Here is a Senate under the leadership of an ass who is in fact seems to be dedicating his life to living off of his wife's family fortunes, and at the same time to deprive ordinary people of their incomes, literally deprive them of their incomes, and yet it is entirely possible that these same people will stay in power. It really just blows my mind.
Well, that's not an accident, and we can talk about that a little bit more later in the show too. Well, why don't we go to the phones?
Okay, I think that's a real good idea. Someone maybe has a brighter idea than we do, or perhaps has a solution to it all, or maybe it's God on the line.
I think it's Dave. Dave, are you with us?
Is Dave there? There's a lot of noise on the line. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes.
Go ahead.
Okay.
Although it's echoing.
I want to bring a different perspective to this. Okay, I don't know if you've noticed, whenever there's a crisis, whether it's 9/11 or the gun shootings or whatever, right after they happen, there's this thing of, well, we don't talk about these things right now. And I don't know who decided, but we're pretty much only limited to what we can really talk about, because we don't talk about certain things right after it happens. And somehow I feel that's the important thing of what we really should be doing, is talking about some of these other things that we don't. And I won't even mention them because they take it. And if you do mention them, people will look at you like, oh, you don't care about people, or you don't, you know, believe in science or whatever. But no, it's not true. And I'll just let it go at that. Thank you.
Okay. I'm thank you for the call, but I'm not sure what it meant.
Well, I think he's referring...
That's probably my problem.
I think he's referring to the fact that the pattern that the country had lapsed into after experiencing one massive shooting after another is that in the immediate aftermath of the shooting, usually the response from the conservative right is, oh, now is not the time to talk about gun reform,
right?
Because these bodies are barely cold. How dare you start talking about this now in the face of tragedy? So we don't talk about it, and then the next tragedy comes around, and we hear the same thing over and over and over.
Well, I think we just need
lather, rinse, and repeat.
I think we just need bigger freezers for the bodies, and we can talk about it much more soon.
Yeah, see, there it is. It's not a moral deficiency or an ethical gap. It's a lack of refrigeration capacity.
Well, that's it. You see, and the refrigeration industry would love this conversation.
Sure. But I think the phenomenon that the caller referenced with regards to mass shootings is a very real one and a pernicious one. But I really have not seen that this time around. The fact that so many of our fellow Americans are dead has galvanized conversation about what should be done. Rather, and I haven't sensed anybody or heard anybody trying to shut that conversation down.
Well,
maybe I'm just missing it.
Maybe there's a divine rule that a certain number of people get killed. It doesn't matter whether they're killed by each other or killed by the virus. It just has to be the certain number, you know?
Well, you know, I think you're onto something, actually. And we brought this up on the last couple of shows. And again, I want to refer people to an article in The Atlantic by Dr. Ibram X. Kendi. The article is entitled, "We're Still Living in a Slaveholder's Republic." And in it, he makes that differentiation that people who really value their liberty, or they conceive of their liberty in terms of what they're able to do to other people, or what they're permitted to do, rather than conceiving of their liberty in terms of what they are free from, mm-hmm. It's those people who have been behind most of what the caller talked about. It's those people who tell us not to talk about gun deaths. It's those people who tell us that the number of people who die from gun violence every year is an acceptable price to pay for their freedom to own guns. And the same people are saying that now that the number of dead Americans we're seeing every day is an acceptable price to pay for their freedom to go out and get a haircut or go out to a bar or what have you. And they generally tend to be the usual suspects.
Well, what you're suggesting is that there is a vast population, and I'm going to say this about them, that really are not in their thinking science-based. In other words, they're know-nothings, and who operate on a sense of grievance about their situation, no matter how well off they are or how problematic their lives are. And they're angry, and they perceive somehow that the system is now moving away from giving them justice and bringing a chance to people who previously they could put their foot on their neck.
Yeah, right. Yeah, and you can apply that broad, apply that broad principle to any one of these specific situations that we've been talking about. Yeah, you're absolutely correct. And by extension, they view the fact that they can't go get their hair cut as the mark of an incredibly oppressive government.
Well, I would like a haircut. I look like hell. But I look like hell with a haircut, too. So.
Yeah, that's fine. I mean, I could use a trim myself. I'm getting pretty shaggy over here. But I think both you and I recognize that perhaps a few more weeks of shaggy hair is a small price to pay.
Besides, we're just ugly, you know?
Well, right. Exactly.
And
so,
no haircut will change that.
Yeah.
Sorry.
We have another couple callers, boys.
The difference between the freedom to do something and the freedom from something is a very important one in our society, and I encourage people to read that piece. I understand we have some phone calls.
Yes, if I could interject here, perhaps
sure.
the all these reopened so-called protests, perhaps that's the mm-hmm. manifestation of the don't talk about it dynamic that Dave mentioned.
You mean it's a magical kind of thinking?
No, it's a way to steer the conversation away from the fact of the pandemic and what's necessary to combat it effectively and how the administration has utterly failed.
Oh, I see. So it's a reframing of the debate. So we're not actually having a huge public health crisis. We're having a crisis of the Constitution. We're having an oppressive government tell us what to do. That's the real problem.
Right.
Right. And I think that is a sincerely held position of not a lot of people, but a significant number of people. And it makes me both angry and sad.
Meanwhile, Corey wanted to jump in. Do we have room for him?
Yeah, let's let Corey jump
sure.
in.
All right. Go Corey, are you still with us?
Yeah. Can you guys hear me? Good morning.
Morning.
Yeah. Hey, good morning. So basically, everything you guys are saying is pretty much spot on. I guess at a macro level, I'm seeing white men with AR-15s, you know, hanging governors in effigy in Kentucky and and in certain places, and not just the South. I think this is happening in Michigan and places like that as well. But it's this psychology of how dare you tell me what to do. Right. Don't tell me to wear a mask. Like, wearing the mask isn't about, it's about me, you know, me protecting you from me, basically. But how dare you tell me to do that? And that's just on a macro level. And Joe mentioned people of color. It's coupled because you not only have that on a micro level. I don't know if you guys saw this, about 24 hours ago, there was a lady in New York City. She had her dog off leash. And the funny part about the video, if you watch the video, she had a mask on the entire time. She had her dog off leash. And a black man told her, can you please put your dog on leash? What she did is she then weaponized her whiteness, got on the phone, called 911. How dare you tell me what to do? I'm going to say that, you know, basically, you know, trying to rile up the cops. So if they did show up and they were there, they could have probably killed this man. But it goes back to that, how dare you, whoever you are, mm-hmm. how dare you tell me what to do? This sort of mentality of how dare you tell us what to do. And like you said, it's all about trying to keep people safe. But this psychology, this American psychology of this whole American dream, you know, pull yourself up by your bootstraps, don't tell me what to do. Instead of thinking about the overall, we're trying to protect people. It's sort of perverse. And before I let you guys go, real quick, I have some friends that work White and Kennedy. I know there's a man, I don't know if you guys know who Sean King is. Sean King has spoken there a couple times. Please don't support Sean King. Sean King is a fraud. He's a huckster. Not trying to go diverge, but just there's a story, I think it was in the Atlantic as well, about Sean King and how his misappropriation, basically what Sean King is doing, every time there is a black tragedy, he's making money off of it, and we don't know where the money's going. So just kind of look into that too, because I don't know if he's been, I don't know, I'm not saying he's been promoted on the show, but I know he's been in Portland a couple times and he's given speeches, but I think he's pretty much a huckster. So that totally diverges from the conversation, but he's doing some really shady stuff right now. But and like I said, I miss you guys. I made it to Washington State. We're about 10 minutes from the border. We actually drove from Texas to Washington State through a pandemic because we don't feel safe. But that's a totally different subject. But we're about 10 minutes from the border. When the border opens up next month, we got to get out of here because we just think that the ignorance going on in this country right now, it's mind-boggling, but it is America. So you either take it or leave it.
So you're looking to escape to Canada? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, and I think escape is a really, really potent word. I think, you know,
in order to move to Canada, you have to have $1 million.
With the rate of exchange, we almost, no, let me stop. I won't go into that, but we're at the border. We're kind of at the border, but we can't cross the border until next month. If they let us cross, that's the funny part, because, you know, if I was in Canada right now, I wouldn't let Americans come over either.
Now, I mean, I'm asking questions here about your personal and family business. So if I can go too far, please let me know. So are you planning then to, is this a temporary escape, or are you going to apply for asylum or permanent residency?
Oh, no, not asylum. We're getting our work visas, my wife and I. So yeah, not asylum. This has been planned, but we just can't cross the border right now. So we're both getting our.
Okay. So this is a long, this is a long held plan. Just the execution's being delayed by the pandemic.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. So this is a long term plan. But like you said, escape is a very pertinent word. And that's the way I feel. Like I said, I'm a person of color. I can get into that. I feel like, yeah, let me escape unless someone calls the cops because I tell her to put her dog on a leash. Let me get up out of here.
It's kind of too bad, man. You were right on the verge of becoming our chief expatriate correspondent. But
it can still happen.
Yeah, I'm disappointed. I'm just disappointed for selfish reasons. if you can do that, if you can move, good luck on it. I think it's an interesting strategy. I remember, of course, during the Vietnam War, lots of people ran the border. They snuck across and ended up hanging out, and the Canadian government was not unfriendly. And then after the war was over, there was a general amnesty of people who'd run away. It was interesting, and it was an example of the actual stupidity of the war itself and the contradictions that were there you know, those who could ran. Those who couldn't had to serve and die.
Yeah. Well, Corey, thanks for the call, man. I always appreciate your input.
Yeah, I do too, Ray. It's great.
Okay. Do we have any other callers standing by, Sonia?
Yes, we do. I think Chris is. Is Chris still on the line?
Yes, I'm.
All right, you are on the air.
Good morning, Chris.
You can hear me okay?
Yes.
Okay.
Don't mind.
Hey, yeah, I called you guys the week the virus started. I don't know if you remember, probably not, but you know, the death rate was estimated at 3.7%. I don't know if you recall, but you guys were kind of insisting that, it's going to be 3.7%.
Well, that's what WHO was saying at the time, yeah.
Yeah, and I was, right, that was based on the Wuhan rate, because they had it first, and it was about 3.7%. And I was making the point, well, once more people get it, it's going to be much less than that, and it is, as 2-3 months later now that we know, it is well under 1%. I think New York estimated it could be as low as 0.1% if you include all the people who are asymptomatic. Therefore, you have to calculate the death rate that we're going to get from here on. Now, how many people got the virus in Oregon yesterday? Do you know?
No, I don't.
22.
Okay. The death rate, new cases yesterday?
22 cases. I don't know. You do the multiplication, it comes out to 1,200 a month. So we're talking about, if the total lockdown worked and we could get it down to zero, which is, I guess, what you guys are suggesting we do,
no, that's
we
not
would
it.
Save about 10 less than 10 lives a month. Is that really worth shutting
down
the economy?
I got to stop this right now. Listen,
your math is faulty and your concepts are faulty. Go ahead, Joe.
But, yeah, unnecessary deaths because of ignorance or because of stubbornness or because of a lack of decent policy, like decent health care, is never excusable, even if it were only one death. You know, if we give up the idea that people should not die needlessly or because of no real lifetime necessity of dying, being old or getting sick from something else, the whole thing becomes really quite clear. It isn't that people are dying. People are always dying. It's that they're dying unnecessarily where there is science to make it much less likely that people will die. And it's very aggravating when we have both a leadership that is busy playing golf while all the rest of us are in risk, and we know that this virus is particularly hard on persons of color and notably hard on Native American people, who God knows have suffered enough under the leadership of the white man. And it becomes really morally disgusting to say, well, it's only going to be X number. It isn't a right way of thinking. The right way to think is, let's do everything we can that humankind will survive as best it can using the techniques that we have available to us, which include testing everybody, by the way, and include people wearing masks and social distancing and a whole bunch of other stuff. And the hell with the banks. Really, the hell with the banks.
You're asking to do a very basic calculus, and you're suggesting that at some place along that spectrum of deaths there is a tipping point. On one side, social distancing and mitigation measures are justified. On the other side of that mark, they are not. I would suggest to you that even conceiving of or placing that mark is an ethical and moral lapse. And secondly, as Joe mentioned, we can't simply talk about this, particularly here in the United States, about this pandemic as if it were a monolith. This is a sickness that affects different populations in different ways, and there are a whole lot of variables that come into play when you consider those situations. It matters what color your skin is. It matters how much money you have. It matters the sort of access the health care that you have. It matters whether you live in a densely populated urban area or in a sparsely populated rural area. All of these things come into play. And when you step back to a 50,000-foot view and you're just talking in raw numbers about how percentage of people who are died, and you start asking questions about, well, is this worth it? I don't know. You might ask somebody in North Dakota if it's worth it. They might say no. You might ask somebody in Midtown Manhattan whether it's worth it, and they'll say absolutely it's worth it. But in the final analysis, there's a Columbia University study that got a lot of press over the last couple of weeks that suggests that had we implemented social distancing measures earlier and had we stuck to them more, in a more disciplined way, we could have saved about 36,000 lives. I don't know how you can look at that figure and say that what we've done has been a waste of time or not worthwhile.
Well, and there's a slippery slope here.
We had to do it because of a high death rate.
Well, let me just say this: if in fact we had a national health system, that would have made it possible to implement all the things that we're talking about right away, and we wouldn't have the clown golfer lying about things and taking fake chemicals and pushing God knows what. None of that would happen. It is not a restriction on freedom. It is not a way of destroying the American lifestyle. It is simply a practical acknowledgement of what science offers for humankind to render us less vulnerable to things like this.
Well, are you still there?
You still there?
Am I on the air?
You are.
Yeah, you're here.
Careful. Careful what you say.
Oh, okay, because you had me on mute, I think. You weren't responding.
No, we don't have control. We're just on telephones.
Oh.
Go ahead.
Okay. Well, I was just trying to point out that, let's say I'm one of the ones laid off, so we've got, and I guess it's a couple hundred thousand here in Oregon. Well, let's say 10 of those, you know, you could have 10 of those people committing suicide because they can't make the rent or they can't make their mortgage. It would, or even more than the number of people who would die from the coronavirus. See what I mean? It's like there's other factors.
I'm not clear of your point. Your point is that people die. We all know people die. We all know our lives are finite, not infinite.
Trying to prevent deaths from coronavirus, right? And in laying off hundreds of thousands of people, you're going to create more deaths from unemployment because they know when the unemployment rate goes up, people start to, you know, get violent or depressed, and they commit murder.
Then that you direct your outrage and your frustration at Mitch McConnell. We could have easily put into place a much more robust emergency support program that would have made sure that people are able to make their mortgage, or they're able to make their ends meet, and most importantly, maintain that relationship with their employer. We didn't do that.
So, if you're talking about
increased deaths from suicide, I would lay that at the feet of an inadequate federal response in terms of fiscal continuity.
And I would have to add, look, this clearly lays bare the reality of the structural weaknesses of our healthcare delivery system, not our science, but our healthcare delivery system. Had we adopted a reasonable healthcare delivery system, we would not be in this situation at all, and the clown prince of golf would not be talking on daily on the TV telling us it's all okay.
Well, I just thought you might want to consider that it is awfully low, 22 cases out of 4.2 million Oregonians, and your chances of getting it are pretty low. We can handle, we've isolated.
Your chances of getting it are pretty high. One of the things we don't have now that will help us, I think, when this is all over, gain a more accurate picture of what really goes on. If you're talking about mortality rate, you need to know the number of actual cases, not just the number of confirmed cases. And this is an area where our lack of comprehensive testing has really let us down. There was an early serology study in New York City, and that is where they test not for the presence of an active virus, but for the presence of antibodies, meaning if I've got antibodies, it means I was exposed and infected and I survived. And that suggests that the number of actual cases is at least twice as high as the number of confirmed cases, if not more. So it's highly communicable. It's really easy to get. That's why this is such a pernicious and deadly problem. There is no immunity in the population for this virus. We are starting to develop that immunity, but at the time it was unleashed upon us, we had none. That's why it was such a problem. Well, people like to make the comparison to the flu, but that's really an apples to oranges comparison. The flu virus is something that's been around for a long time. We have a degree of limited immunity amongst the population, but even still, you hear a chorus every time flu season comes around to get yourself a flu shot so that you are immunized. The coronavirus came upon us absolutely out of nowhere, and we had no immunity, even at a limited scale.
And the only modifier that could have been there was that the administration, the government, the national government, could have been paying attention, could have listened to the CDC, could have done a lot of things. It chose, as I say, to play golf. And this is really what this is about. It's about a who wants to play golf. It's not about how many people are tolerable to die. It's not about that at all. It's about a rational approach to disease. Part of the great struggle of humankind from early on, sometimes magical, sometimes rational and scientific, but all that great struggle is about the idea that humanity is worth saving, not worth just letting go.
It seems like the CDC and the authorities, the highest, even Dr. Fauci or whatever his name is, has not given us an actual goal. Like, what is the actual goal of the lockdown? Like, how long, if we lock down for 6 months, 3 months, what is the end game? They're not saying.
They have given us an end game. Have you just not been paying attention? I'm starting to wonder. Here's the end game. Okay, there's something when you talk about virus transmissibility, or really transmissibility of any pathogen, there's a number called the R-naught number. And that tells you how many people in a social situation are going to pass the virus on to somebody else. An R-naught of 1 means 1 infected person passes it on to 1 other infected person, and the virus continues to spread. The goal through social distancing and mitigation is to drop that R-naught number below 1. Meaning that each positive case is infecting less than 1, statistically speaking, other person. That means the virus is slowing its spread and the outbreaks are starting to contract rather than to grow. That is the whole point of social mitigation. Now, the plan, as outlined by Dr. Fauci, and the plan as is being executed in other countries, is to bring that R-naught number below 1, establish a rigorous testing program, so that we're easily able to find new outbreaks where they flare up, and couple that robust testing with a contact tracing system, so that as soon as a new case pops up, they can immediately find everybody that person is associated with and test them as well. Now, we have none of those last two pieces in place. There are some municipalities, some counties in the country that have appropriate testing capacity right now, and there are some fewer who are bringing along their contact tracing abilities to the level they need to be. But we have nothing like that on a coordinated national level. So the plan, as outlined by Dr. Fauci, has been utterly bungled by the President of the United States and by the rest of his executive branch.
And he cheats at golf. Don't forget that, too.
Meanwhile, I believe Don is on the line. Don, are you still with us?
Okay. Yes, I'm still here.
Don.
You're on the air, Don. Go ahead.
Oh, yes. Thank you for the conversation. I just wanted to contribute to one simple thought that the concept of freedom has been slowly over time distorted in that as long as we as Homo sapiens live with each other, we have to fraternity, which is the economic realm. We have egalite, which is the rights realm for each of us to have rights. We have liberté, which is what exists in the realm of spiritual practice, thought, and religious observation. And slowly we've managed to allow that concept of liberté to be brought into the realm of rights and economy, which means we can do whatever we want. But actually the only legitimate realm in which we are free to do whatever we want is the realm of liberté, is thought, spiritual practice, and inner life.
Well, I wanted, since you brought up a very famous French demand for justice, where the hell in that is fraternité? Where is that brotherhood?
Where is that acknowledgement that we're all here together and we're all struggling together? And all of us have lives that, for us at least, have meaning and are, in fact, important.
Yes. Sorry, was that a question? I didn't...
No, it was a hypothetical. You don't, it's not a... you can answer it if you want to, but you needn't. I mean, I'm just making a point here.
Yes. I think it's just... Yeah. Your point was well taken. Thank you.
Yeah. Appreciate your comment. It's always nice to hear a French Revolution reference thrown into our show.
Well, we're just all intellectual as hell, aren't we?
Yeah, we are. We're here in a high and mighty academic ivory tower.
That's why they pay me the big bucks.
Or me in my basement, as the case may be.
Really? Listen, I do think there's really something here in this conversation that is disturbing to me in a meta moral sense. Any lives lost for no reason, any lives lost that could be saved, is a moral horror. And we as a people should not tolerate that. We as a people need to understand that we need to take care of each other, because in the end, other is us.
Yeah, you're absolutely correct. Other is us. Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, because we're seeing that dichotomy play out all over the place. For example, in California, there was emergency relief funding appropriated for COVID-19 in the undocumented community in California, because the governor and the state administration there realized quite prudently that to give aid to one community based on the fact that they have the right papers, and to withhold it from another based on the fact that they don't, is not only inherently unjust, but unsound public health policy. The undocumented community breathes the same air, they drink the same water, they congregate in many of the same places.
They mow your lawn and they clean your house.
Right. And the virus does not discriminate. So really, any life loss, as you mentioned, Joe, is a massive moral failure, and that extends to people whether they're the U.S. citizens or not, whether they have documentation or not, because as I mentioned, they are equally vulnerable to the virus, and they're equally able to spread the virus to people who are citizens and do have documentation. So to sit back from a distance and to say, well, the mortality percentage is only so high, and really over the long term that's only so many deaths, maybe that's something we can live with, that is nihilism, that is reprehensible, that is just a moral black pit. And I don't want to go there. Hang on, let me wrap this up. And further, when I hear people saying that, really the first thing that springs to my lips is, well, are you going to volunteer then? Are you going to say, okay, step up and take my life, take my grandparents' life, take my aunts and uncles? We're willing to die. The economy must go on. But, somehow I don't think that's what these people mean when they suggest that the economy should just go on.
Well, and I just want to go back to the very fundamental reality. We don't have national health care. If we had national health care, with its many potential failings, even so, this whole thing would be much more easy to manage. And in fact, it would have been discovered and acted on earlier. It is the fact that we have a system that is, in terms of its technology, in terms of its theoretical modeling of disease, is high, but in terms of its service to the people, is rotten. This is a very wealthy nation. It can afford good health care. It's insane not to have it, and this is a proof of that insanity, this virus. And it's,
I don't. Mitch McConnell is suggesting that perhaps a tax cut might be just the thing right now.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, I would like that.
but your point is well taken, and I think when you juxtapose the public health problem with the economic catastrophe that's going on right now, and I don't think we on the left should try to downplay the seriousness of the economic catastrophe. It is a catastrophe that we're talking about right now. If in this country, most health insurance is coupled with employment. You got to have a job if you want to have health care, and in a climate like now, where literally tens of millions of people have lost work, that those same tens of millions of people, if they haven't lost it already, are going to lose their health care very soon. And in the midst of a massive health care crisis, that's exactly the wrong situation you want to be in.
And it doesn't just have to do with the virus. It has to do with the general availability of health care, which goes back to my point. The fundamental problem is not that a creepy disease has come and taken us by surprise, which it didn't really. It's not that problem. It's the problem that we don't have a serviceable, rational system to deal with a pandemic. We have never really put that together. Even after the disaster of 1918, and by the way, you might want to remind Trump it wasn't 1917.
Yes, someone should remind him of that. Well, there were a lot of other things we wanted to get to on today's show. You know, and I'm not sorry we didn't get to them, because I think the conversation has been a good one today. But there is something I want to touch on before the end of the hour.
Please.
And that is that, you know, of course, even as we're dealing with this situation that I think is safe to say is completely unprecedented in most of our lives, we are also in the middle of a presidential election year. And I wish I could say it was shocking or, you know, that I was surprised in some way, but the Republicans are trying, even in the midst of a pandemic, even in the midst of another Great Depression, to limit people's ability to vote in the upcoming election. This is something I've been following pretty carefully for a number of years, because it's a huge and systematic problem in this country. Voter suppression is what I'm talking about. Now, in California, the governor, Gavin Newsom, issued an executive order that said applications for absentee ballots are going to be mailed to every single registered voter in California. Now, what that means is people will be able to opt in to vote by mail if they want to. It's not an automatic system like we have here in Oregon, but California is a state that allows vote by mail. It is just not universal like it is here. So the governor said, okay, there's a pandemic on. We're going to make sure that everybody's able to cast their vote through the mail. Of course, the president immediately came out and denounced that move. He suggested on national TV that the election in California is compromised. Even before a vote has been cast, he has suggested that it's a fraudulent election. And now the Republican National Committee has sued California to halt vote by mail in the November election. Now, if you want to talk about morally reprehensible positions and absolutely indefensible political moves, this is one of them. It's hard for me to even comprehend this here, other than to say that long ago, the Republicans crossed that threshold where people's right to vote was secondary to their desire to hold on, to consolidate and expand their own power.
No, and not only that, but Trump actually said on TV that if there is mail-in ballots, the Republicans will lose.
Yes, yeah. He again, he said the quiet part out loud, didn't he?
Yeah, he did.
Yeah, well, that's too bad. If that's the case, if increased voter participation means your particular political party will suffer, the answer then is to perhaps reconsider your worldview, perhaps retool your platform so that it's more broadly acceptable by the electorate. That would be the rational and responsible thing to do, but that's not what they have done. Instead, they have decided, well, we'll just make sure that the wrong people aren't able to vote. And we're seeing that now, even in the midst of the greatest crisis this country has seen since the Great Depression. It's astonishing, and this is something that we have to push back against with everything we have. We can't go out and demonstrate, so you're going to have to stay in, you're going to have to make phone calls, and you're going to have to send emails. This is what it's going to take. People have to be able to vote. We're talking about, you mentioned earlier in the show, Joe, that there is a set of circumstances in which Trump wins re-election. And an essential component of every one of those circumstances is making sure that the wrong people cannot cast a vote.
And this is not a new thing. It's just more gross.
No. Yeah, it's just more gross this time around. Exactly. So this is something we absolutely must resist. So I encourage you to write to the governor of California in support of his move. Write to your congresspeople in support of things like vote by mail. Write to congresspeople and governors in other states who may not have vote by mail and encourage them to put into place any measures they can between now and election day to make sure that as many people as possible are able to safely cast their vote. Every state is going to matter in this election. The structural inequalities built into our constitutional system favor the Republicans at this point in time. That's so it's going to take everybody. It is true.
No, it absolutely is true. Not only that, it's a peculiar, I don't think, accident that the long-term Republican attack on something that was created in the constitutional in the Constitution and really an initiation by Benjamin Franklin is now constantly under attack, and that's the National Postal Service, because it's a great equalizer. It's a great device for fairness in communication, and originally it was designed, I think, to make sure that publications, advocacy through newspapers and so on, would be cheap. But the fact of the matter is that the post office has been unfairly burdened by a total manipulation of the reserves of cash that they are required to carry. And the result of that is that we are looking at a system that can actually collapse. And this administration would love that to happen. They've been propagandizing against the post office forever.
Yeah. One of the things we've mused about on this program in our darker moments is, should President Trump lose a closely contested election, would he step aside from power under those circumstances? Or would he characterize the election as fraudulent and refuse to step aside?
Oh, I'm sure he would. I think there will be a crisis of that kind if it's close.
Yeah.
Even if it's not close. I mean, look, we're all being kind of careful around this. The fact of the matter is we have a fascist idiot in charge of our government, and he gathers around him the most sycophantic fascist idiots that he can, because they all are yes persons, and this is a disgusting situation, and it cannot be allowed to prevail, and the only way it can be gotten rid of is through democracy itself, and we, all of us, must struggle for that. It's not something where we can wring our hands and say, oh, you know, and they're all alike or whatever. No, this is a clear example, an absolute example of the terrifying potential of a crazy, nutty, ambitious, paranoid individual.
Yes, not to mention a guy who knows quite clearly that the only thing standing between him and prison is his elected office.
And he cheats at golf.
Yeah, he cheats at golf, which seems to be pretty important, Joe, because you've brought it up now several times.
Well, I think it's funny.
Well, I think it's funny, and I think it's illustrative as well.
Yeah. I mean, so, in the petty things, he cheats. And I don't want to get into some of his other behavior that's petty, but, you know.
Well, it's like that old adage, right? You know, if somebody lies about the small things, then, you know, you can expect them to lie about the big things, too. And that's very much the case with this president. So I would put it out there to our progressive listenership that we need to have a plan in place should the president decide to contest the results of the upcoming presidential election. We need to know ahead of time how we're going to react to that situation. And hopefully, if the president does contest the results of the election, we will have extricated ourselves from this pandemic to the extent that we're able to take to the streets, because we're absolutely going to have to take to the streets if he does that.
I agree. I think that this is really a crisis. It's certainly a health crisis, and it's certainly a management crisis, but it's also a crisis of the survival of a free state. And this is very real, and it's very, very, very much coming and rushing toward us. And I'm afraid that by November, we're going to see something that we've never seen before.
Indeed. It's also about the survival of what's left of a free state. Because anyone who's been paying attention realizes the extent to which the notion of a free republic has been compromised in this country over the years. The pace of that deterioration has accelerated under this president, and not by accident.
Well, and so, you said it, but it's really true. Trump knows that if he loses, he goes to jail.
Yeah, he does go to jail. Yeah.
And he does not pass go, and he does not get the $200, and he needs in his mind that $200. That's a reference to Monopoly, those of you who don't.
Yeah. I'm aware.
I knew you were.
Yeah, indeed. So what we didn't get to on the show includes what we absolutely need to see out of the next round of federal stimulus legislation, and I want to
I think we should do that next week, maybe. Huh?
We should, but I want to dip my toe into that conversation right now by saying, first, that we absolutely, beyond a shadow of a doubt, need another round of federal stimulus legislation before this is over.
And it should go to small businesses and ordinary people. It should not be going, as it has been going, to the big banks and the big corporations and the meat packers who make their workers work under conditions that give them the virus.
No. This needs to put money into the hands of working people. So with the Republicans in charge of the Senate, we can rest assured that that's probably not going to happen to the extent that it needs to, and that also people who already have a whole lot of butter on their bread are going to see another big dollop of butter spooned on there by Senator McConnell and his cronies. But it has to happen, and there are certain things that that legislation must include. And like you said, we're going to have to save that conversation next week.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I think we've done a good job as much as we can do on the telephone.
Oh, I'm not. I don't mind the telephone so much.
Oh, I hate it.
Yeah, we all got to make that.
I'm a technophobe. What can I say? It's,
oh my God, is that ever true? Listeners,
yeah, really.
You have no idea.
I think tin cans on a string is the best way to go.
That might be the case. Time. I want to thank everybody who called up today and joined in the conversation. We appreciate you as always. And please, it's not safe yet to go out there and resume your normal lives. It is not safe yet.
And it's time to give a whole bunch of what you can afford to give in the way of money to cable. Because without that money, it all goes silent.
That's true. So this has been the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Program on KBOO 90.7 FM. If you want to make a contribution, go to kboo.fm, click on the donate button. We need your support during this time more than ever. Frankly, the Republic needs your support during this time more than ever. So be safe, be well, and we'll be back at you next time.
We'll see you next week.